This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll talk with Stephen Barnett. He is the director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University, a champion for early childhood education. We'll talk with Dr. Barnett. Also, the University of Louisiana System President Sandra Woodley. She heads 9 different universities with 90,000 students in Louisiana. We'll talk with her about the state of higher education in our state, and in particular, the schools that she represents. And we'll also hear from Max McLean. His production is the Screwtape Letters, making its Baton Rouge debut Saturday. McLean is director and co-creator of the production, as well as producer, former starring actor, and president of the New York City-based nonprofit The Fellowship for the Performing Arts. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest at this time is Dr. Stephen Barnett, Board of Governors Professor and Director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. He was a guest last night of the Academic Distinction Fund here in Baton Rouge and is a man who knows much about education and particularly the long-term effects of preschool programs on children's learning and development. Good morning, Dr. Barnett.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, this is a big subject. You've authored or co-authored more than 180 publications. I don't know how you have time to do anything else other than write.
Well, I'm not a young guy, so it's been a while.
180, though. That means several per year. So this is a subject that is of interest. It's fertile and it's fluid. So what are the latest developments regarding the costs and benefits and the long-term effects of preschool programs on children?
Well, I think the latest is that there's a pretty substantial return to investing in quality early education. But the key word there is quality.
And how do we get there?
Well, we have to have high standards, put the resources behind the high standards, and then have adequate monitoring and accountability, or as I tend to call it, a continuous improvement system.
Well, the high standards are such that some people have different ideas on how to get there. What's the best way, in your judgment, as an expert?
Well, I don't know that there's one path, but the research on this is pretty clear about what the active ingredient is, and that's a good teacher one-on-one or small group interacting with a child around a particular child's needs. It's not what children need. Every parent knows it's what your child needs.
You've done state-by-state analysis through the years, haven't you?
Yep. Every year we look at each state's policies.
So how does Louisiana compare with New Jersey and other states?
Well, Louisiana has some innovative policies. A number of programs that are very creative, reasonable standards, and a new roadmap that's very interesting. But what Louisiana hasn't done is put the money behind the policies, and especially during the recession. Spending per child dropped about $2,000.
Per child?
Per child.
And how does this, is this reflective of a nationwide trend, or is this just Louisiana?
Well, I'd say overall, most states went down in terms of their support during the recession. Some states bucked that trend, and many states are now reversing and not just backfilling the hole they dug during the recession, but actually moving ahead to restore funds. And I think that remains to be seen whether Louisiana is going to follow suit.
Stephen Barnett is our guest. Dr. Barnett is a Board of Governors professor and director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. Now, the program that you direct, this one that I just cited, the National Institute, how many people are involved in this?
We have about 20 full-time researchers, a lot more people out there collecting data than that.
And your research demonstrates that early education produces significant improvements in child development. and it yields substantial economic returns. How so?
I give you a good example. In New Jersey, because of court order, we invested in what is probably the highest quality, most intensive preschool program in the country. We took the child care programs children were in and turned them from poor to mediocre to good to excellent over 8 years. So what happened to the kids? Those kids are now in fifth grade. They have substantially higher achievement test scores. They were much less likely to have to repeat a grade. They're much less likely to be in special education. So the state's already saving money because they didn't have to go to third grade twice, because they didn't need special education, which costs twice as much per year as regular education. And those things are also your best predictors of high school graduation. So these kids are going to be much less likely to drop out, which means they'll be less likely to go to prison and more likely to have a decent job in the workforce.
When's the best time to start early education?
Best time to start early education is actually prenatally. At that point, it's not so much education of the child as education of the parent to make sure parents not smoking, not stressed, and not abusing substances, so that when the child's born, they're in the best shape to be ready to learn. And then learning starts from there on in.
But as you know, sometimes that's not the reality. Maybe the ideal, but not the reality. So you have to deal with what you've got. And some kids come into the world with great disadvantages, and those continue. And how do you make up for the lost ground?
Well, you make up for the lost ground with intensive early education from a teacher who's been specially trained, well-educated, to know how to reach each individual child and maximize their potential. Many kids, the kind of kids you're talking about, they're 2 years behind when they start kindergarten. They will never catch up. We got to get them at least, you know, make up a year and a half. I'm not saying you get them back to the average. But if they start 6 months behind instead of 2 years, now they got a shot at making it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the world has changed since you and I were young, but my first formal education was when I was 5 years old and went to kindergarten. Why isn't that sufficient today?
Well, it's not sufficient today for a couple of reasons. One is the world's a vastly more competitive place today. The labor market is international. Our kids got to compete with kids from South Korea, Singapore, Shanghai, Berlin. And our kids can't be 2 years behind those kids if we're going to successfully compete for good jobs.
For parents or a parent who doesn't have the resources or doesn't think they have the resources, what do they do?
Well, parents can do a lot on their own. Parents are very powerful. Read to your child, FaceTime. It means, you know, one-on-one, looking in your child's eyes, talking with them. Do math. Right? You know, math can be working on a child with a recipe. Mm-hmm. It can be figuring out proportions when you're adding the cleaner to the water to wash the car. Lots of things parents can do.
Let's say everything is even between two kids, background, and one has had the preschool development that you espouse and the other has not. By the time they're an adult, will there be a distinct difference?
Studied a group of kids where we randomly assigned them. One group went to preschool, one didn't. They're now in their 50s. I can tell you the difference. The group who went to preschool, less likely to go to jail, more likely to have a job, made more money, more likely to own their home and have a second car. They're not huge differences, but they're not small.
They're not small.
They're not small. The difference in high school graduation rates was 50% versus two-thirds.
What about social skills?
Social skills, tremendously important. They're just as much a factor in your success if you persevere, try hard, play by the rules, take personal responsibility, don't blame other people. Children learn those and develop habits and attitudes about those in the first 5 years of life. It's not too late to change them later, but I think anybody who's read their Bible knows there's a long history of understanding. We want to teach kids those things very early.
You've also discussed and studied language, in particular dual language immersion. How does that affect development?
Well, two languages is better than one, and learning two languages doesn't slow you down learning one. So if you learn Spanish and English, for example, as a preschooler, you don't fall behind in English, and now you have two languages. That's a marketable capability, and just in terms of human development, it turns out you're less likely to get Alzheimer's if you're fully bilingual.
You are.
You are.
And is there any reason?
Sure. You've developed more of your brain capacity. You've developed, I won't say excess wiring, but more connections in the brain. And the more you've developed those, sort of the more spare you have when dementia starts cutting back on it.
Why is there not a widespread call? And certainly there is some, but why aren't people beating down the doors of state capitals and the nation's capitals saying that we need funding for the kinds of programs that you believe are vital to development of the young people who will be the people who are leaders of our country?
I think two things. One, we need to get the word out so that people are better informed. That's really one of the major jobs of my institute, is to make sure the public understands what policies are and what the costs and benefits are. Right. And then most people don't have young children. People who have young children, grandparents of young children, they understand this.
Well, Stephen Barnett is the head of the Board of Governors and director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. He's been doing this for a long time. We're glad you spent some time in Baton Rouge and with us today. We look forward to talking with you down the line.
Thank you, Jim.
And thank you for the Academic Distinction Fund for making Dr. Barnett's appearances possible here in our community. And we're joined in studio by Dr. Sandra Woodley, who is president of the University of Louisiana System. She's held this post for a year and 3 weeks now. It's one of the largest public university systems in the country. Bobby Jindal held this job at one time. The University of Louisiana System enrolls 90,000 students at nine universities, an operating budget of over $750 million. And hats off to the five universities that are open today in the University of Louisiana system. People are hard at work at UNO, Louisiana Tech, Nichols, Grambling, and the University of Louisiana Monroe. And Dr. Sandra Woodley, thank you for braving the elements. Actually, it wasn't much of the elements, just the closed roads to make it to our studio.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Well, good to see you. Native of Alabama, graduate of Auburn University, and an untraditional student in your own right.
Yes, you know, it took me 10 years, I like to say, and two babies to get my undergraduate degree, so I definitely did not take the easy path.
How did you stay the course?
Well, determination mostly. I think when I got married at 18 and found myself in my 20s with two small children, it became apparent pretty quickly that I needed to get my degree and very badly wanted to do so. So it took a lot of work and a lot of time, and many colleges and the community colleges were a big friend to me over my period of years. Student financial aid helped, and so a lot of students in our system are in my boat as well.
And you went all the way and got your doctorate in business administration.
Yes, I did.
How many years did it take to do the whole shebang?
Oh, my gosh, I need my calculator. A lot.
Well, it's quite a success story for Dr. Woodley, who, of course, is a great example for those who are going to college. Prior to coming to Louisiana, she served as chief financial officer and strategic planner in university systems in Texas, Arizona, Kentucky, and Alabama. And we will return with Dr. Sandra Woodley. If you'd like to join the conversation, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, 877-217-5757. Dr. Sandra Woodley is with us. She is president of the University of Louisiana System, which includes Grambling, Louisiana Tech, McNeese State, Nicholls State, Northwestern State, Southeastern Louisiana, University of Louisiana at Lafayette, University of Louisiana Monroe, and the University of New Orleans. And she has been on the job for 1 year for one of the largest systems in the United States. And what's your read after a year on the job?
Well, I am actually very encouraged about where the universities are. It's been a difficult several years for them. We're excited about the years coming up. And I think we've got a lot of hard work ahead of us, though. And I think we've got a lot of really good initiatives helping to achieve these things.
Now, the student enrollment, 60% female.
Mm-hmm. Girl power.
Yeah.
Although we need to get some more boys in there. You know, that's a national thing that we're worried about. We need to make sure that we...
Is this consistent with national
Yeah, I think,
things?
You know, there is a lot nationally about the fact that girls are starting to kind of out-achieve men on the graduation attainment. And we'd like to see all of our children get a degree.
All right. 34% minority.
Yes.
And the average age... 25.
Yeah, so see, we have a non-traditional student body as well. I mean, we do have some traditional campuses, but there are a lot of students like me who have to take longer than 4 or 6 years to get a degree. And so I think we've got to make sure that we have strategies in place to take care of all of those students.
25% are on TOPS, and 42% of the students in the University of Louisiana system, the first-time freshmen, are on Pell Grants. So
yes.
Most are receiving some kind of financial assistance.
That's right.
Well, the state budget this year looks a little better for higher education than it has in preceding years. There is a budget increase, but much of that, most of it, is through a tuition hike.
Mm-hmm.
How can you sustain the growth and the success if students are continuing to have to pay more to go to school?
Well, you know, we are always concerned about affordability, and it is true that our rates are still relatively low, even with all of the hikes over the coming years. We take affordability very seriously in the system, and we're constantly monitoring that. We also are really proud of the new trust fund, the Workforce Incentive Fund, that will allow us to put targeted funds towards these high-degree, high-demand fields. And we think that's going to be a good strategy for us, not only to help the economy, but also to increase our graduation rates as well.
Well, Governor Jindal has revealed that $141 million in increased funding will come for higher education, but of that, $88 million is in the form of a tuition increase, and that leaves $53.5 million, $40 million for workforce development that must be matched by $8 million in private funding. How will that happen?
Yeah, we're excited about that, and we think we're going to be able to get that match relatively easy. We have lots of business and industry out there who are really concerned about being able to get the graduates that they need out of our universities for the workforce. So many different areas of demand that we are trying to do. Now, the resources are important for us to be able to ramp up our programs and hire the faculty to be able to produce these degrees. And we think that this is a really creative way to go out and leverage private dollars. And not only that, but to be very intentional and specific with our industry partners about what do you need? What kind of curricular changes do you need? And what kind of graduates do you need? And we're looking for very specific partnerships with our industry leaders, and we're excited about it.
I'm sure you've heard some of the criticism, Dr. Woodley, about Louisiana having an abundance of four-year institutions,
sure.
And maybe a good idea would be to shut some of them down. How do you answer people who have expressed that sentiment?
Well, I think we have a growing demand for graduates. And so, you know, I think it's less about the number of institutions you have and more about the demand for the graduates. And so my focus has been on making sure that we streamline our programs and that we're responsive in our programs to industry needs. And so we have a particularly exciting new initiative at the University of Louisiana System that will help us with that. And if you're listening on this call and you've got children in college or you are yourself in college, we encourage you to go to myedu.com And this is a partnership we have with a private company that's going to help students find a job, create their online searchable resume, and to navigate through the undergraduate situation. And this series of apps also connects business and industry very directly with our students as early as freshman year. So internships and jobs are posted directly to our students so that they can actually see the pathway and work their way back.
2975633. There are about 545,000 working adults in the state who took college courses but did not finish the course and get their degrees. Some 20,000 of those took classes during the UL or at UL system universities in the past decade. And you're encouraging them to come back and get their diploma. What advantages are there of doing this?
Well, you know, it's never too late. I had a friend once who was about 40 years old, and she goes, I really want to get my degree, but do you know how old I'll be when I finish my degree? And I said, well, how old will you be in 4 years if you don't finish your degree? So, you know, let's encourage all of those adults out there who have some college or no college to go back. And we at the University of Louisiana System want to be the place that makes it very easy for you to do that. Our new online degree, our Bachelor of Arts in Organizational Leadership, is 100% online. It's targeted specifically for those adult students who are 25 and older who have, you know, 60 credits in the bank. And we have a specialty at each one of our universities that these students can choose from. We think this is the beginning of a way for our system to be very responsive to adult students.
How do people find out more about the online degrees?
Well, you can absolutely go to our website where you can see the online degree. You can find it on our website.
2975633 is your number. Our guest is Dr. Sandra Woodley, who's president of the UL system. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And she is encouraging over 500,000 working adults in the state who went to college here in our state, didn't get their degrees, 20,000 of them in the UL system over the past decade, to come back and finish their degrees. And I did not realize that the average age of the students in the system is 25 years old.
I have a lot of adult students.
Well, yeah. And, you know, obviously you still have a lot who are 18 and 19.
Of course.
So that means there are a lot of people on campus who are in their 30s.
Yes.
Getting their bachelor degrees.
That's true.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that.
2975633, and we'll go to the phone lines in just a moment for Dr. Woodley, who has braved the elements. And it is a beautiful day out there if you want to experience winter in all its glory in Baton Rouge and surrounding areas. This is a good day to do it. Dr. Sandra Woodley is here to take all comers. And we'll start with Gaston in South Baton Rouge. Hi, sir. You're on WRKF with Dr. Woodley.
Hey, good morning. I'm glad to have y'all doing this show. But I was curious, how come we don't link higher education with your earlier guest, early education?
Well, you know, I think that's something that we have to do more of. We are, with our project with myedu.com, this online portal that helps students navigate and find a job, we are actually beginning to link that with LOSFA. The Student Financial Aid Association has an online portal where they have 8th graders through 12th graders to get on to learn about what they have to do to be successful in college. How do they get financial aid? And part of what LOSFA does as well is it tries to educate students about jobs and degree programs. We are partnering with LOSFA to do the very thing that you're mentioning. We do have to start earlier than freshman year. Students need to know how to be successful in our colleges, and they need to know what we offer. So we are definitely about to really seriously ramp that up.
Jared at LSU. Jared, you're on the air with Dr. Sandra Woodley. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. And I just wanted to make a comment followed by a question. I'm an out-of-state PhD student at LSU, and I've been amazed at the brain drain from LSU in biology and renewable natural resources alone. I mean, just in the past year, we lost Dr. Whitehead to Davis, Carson to Ohio, Chamberlain to Georgia, Stevens to Texas, just to name a few in the past couple years. Mm-hmm. And I've heard from them that they haven't received raises for a very long time and find the political environment hostile to academia. For example, graduation waivers for graduate students have been stopped, another affront to a functioning research program. And I just wanted to hear what you plan to do to mitigate the kind of evisceration of LSU's research program.
Well, myself and my colleagues in the systems are working on strategies for what I like to call a 20-year march towards national competitiveness. And you're absolutely right. If Louisiana is going to be nationally competitive, we have to ramp up the resources, not just for resources' sake, but to be able to recruit and retain the best and the brightest faculty. That's the lifeblood of what we do in higher education. That dictates the quality of our education, and we're seriously concerned about it. We think these new resources that the governor puts in is a great starting point for that, but we think more will have to be done over the coming years, and you'll be hearing a lot more from myself and King Alexander and Ron Mason and whomever becomes the head of the community college system in this regard. We have to protect those resources in our institutions for Louisiana's future.
You and King Alexander have become friends, haven't you?
King and I have been friends for many years. King and I worked together in Kentucky. We were colleagues when I was at the coordinating board there, and he was the president at Murray State. We have a long history together, and I'm a big fan of King Alexander.
Meg on Highland. Hi, Meg. You're on with Dr. Sandra Woodley.
Yes, hello. Dr. Woodley, I know that a number of institutions in the University of Louisiana system are on the AAUP censure list.
Yes.
I was wondering what you plan to do about getting these institutions off the censure list.
Well, it's a complicated issue, and we are certainly concerned about that. We care very much for faculty. The other part of that story, of course, is that the financial situation has been so austere that institutions have had to do some drastic measures to try to balance their budgets in these times. So these two things cause difficulties in that particular issue. We are working with AAUP to try to pull our institutions off censure, and we're also revamping our policies to make sure that we have the best chance at not having that issue in the future again. But I will say, it is very difficult in these financial times to make all of those things work.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Still time to get in under the wire with Dr. Sandra Woodley, who for a year and 3 weeks has been president of the University of Louisiana system. That's the job that Governor Jindal held before he became a member of the U.S. Congress. And when he ran for governor in 2003, his most recent state post was head of the UL system. He was quite proud of the system. He even said once on the air with yours truly that if he had not gone to Brown University, he would have gone to one of these universities.
Awesome.
Are the universities equal, or there's some that are better than others?
Well, that's a great question, Jim. All of our universities are special, and you know, they each have a different niche that they work on. You know, we're proud of all of our universities, and we all need to improve.
And some are good in specific programs.
That's right.
Can you name one? Let's pick one.
Well, I mean, you know, Louisiana Tech and their engineering and their engineering tech and their sciences. I mean, they have, you know, just a great reputation. We have many of our institutions who do a lot in the, which is a very high demand area in the computer sciences, you know, New Orleans and, mm-hmm. and Lafayette and others. Nichols has, you know, great programs in, you know, environmental, you know, biology and culinary and jazz, and, you know, New Orleans and jazz. We just have a whole long list of really programs to be proud of.
I know Louisiana Tech, which you state, has a reputation in some areas that's quite outstanding, particularly mm-hmm. engineering. It's been cut hard by budget cuts in the last few years.
Yeah, all of the institutions, you know, have had struggles in that area, and we're very excited about the opportunity to trek back in the other direction for each one of our universities.
What about a merger of, say, Tech and Grambling? Is that practical?
Probably not at this time. You know, I think they serve different populations and they have a different niche. I think our focus is to try to make all of our institutions as strong as they can be at this point.
Syed, downtown. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Sandra Woodley.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Sandra Woodley, I'm about to retire and I work for the state. And I was trying to get some courses in the hardware and software for the computers. Mm-hmm. And I was not able to find anything. I found one course which helps it, which is not actually what I wanted, but still it helps me. It will help me. Mm-hmm. But the problem is they are offered at the daytime for the whole week, mm-hmm. and I cannot take off for a whole week. So mm-hmm. can you do something for the old people like us?
Yeah, we're working hard on that, and I think you point out a very important issue that we're working on, and that is we have to make it easy for people like you to find what we offer, and we are ramping up a strategy to be able to make that more evident. My EDU will help with that, but we need to do better. And I think it's also true when you look at our org leadership, this is just the beginning of what we plan to do, and online doesn't solve every problem, but I think we do have to be much more responsive to our adult students who can't go during 8 to 5 during the day. I myself, struggled with that. So I hear what you're saying, and I think you'll find that the University of Louisiana system will increasingly become even more responsive to that issue over the coming years.
Carl at LSU asks about the firing of some tenured faculty at Southeastern. What do you know about this?
Well, you know, as I said, all of the institutions have had to make really tough decisions to be able to balance their budgets. All of our institutions have been living on their savings account, so to speak, you know, balancing the budget out of reserves that are quickly running out. So even though, you know, there's new funding rolling in next year, institutions like Southeastern have had to reorganize and have had to streamline programs. And unfortunately, that means that some faculty do not retain their jobs as they've tried to do the reorganization. I mean, it's just a sad, sad thing, and we're not happy about that. But I think in the grand scheme of things, the institutions have to do what they can to give themselves the best future. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that means making very difficult decisions.
How did you become interested in this job?
Well, you know, for a long time, I thought that this would be a good position for me to be the leader of a higher ed system. And as you can see from my resume, I've spent time in 5 systems. And so when Louisiana came calling, I looked at, you know, the kind of students that they served and what they did in this state, and I felt it a particular challenge that would be something that I could help with. And so I'm really happy mm-hmm. to be here.
I've forgotten, was it public when you were in the hunt for the job?
I think so, yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, there was, as you may or may not know, a big dispute at LSU about...
I've heard.
Yeah, you have heard, probably from King Alexander himself. He said at the press club that he would not have offered his name as a candidate if he would have been exposed as a candidate, that he might have lost his job yeah. where he was.
It's a difficult balance. And so I actually appreciate the problem that institutions have in trying to kind of balance between transparency and the ability to make sure you can attract people who would like privacy as long as they can. I don't think there's an easy answer mm-hmm. to that.
What's the biggest challenge awaiting you?
I think the biggest challenge is trying to navigate the finances and being able to coordinate the programs in a way that makes these changes evident.
Well, you've got a big job, 90,000 students.
Yeah, it's great.
And the average age is 25.
That's right.
But 90,000 is, when it's a state with 4.5 mm-hmm. million people, mm-hmm. according to my math, that's 2% of the state going to your university. So.
Yeah.
You got a lot of folks who are expecting attention and production, and you say things are getting better despite the budget,
that's the
budget constraints.
I think things are getting better.
Okay. Well, we look forward to a progress report sometime soon. Thank you for joining us on a challenging day to get to anywhere and to get to these studios, not because of the elements today, but because of road closures. 297-5633. We're slated to hear from Max McLean when we return after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. Thank you, Dr. Woodley. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And our guest is Max McLean, president and artistic director of Fellowship for the Performing Arts. In New York City, the lead actor, director, and author of the theatrical adaptation of C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters, and the production is going to be in Baton Rouge tomorrow night at the River Center. Good morning, Max McLean.
Good morning.
Now, you brought this to New York City, 309 performances in 2010 and 2011, and I'm sure you're heartened at the response.
Yes. Well, Lewis is certainly worthy of thinking, adapting from the page to the stage. He's got a huge audience. And we did believe that we were faithful to the book and executed at a high level, that we would find an audience, and we have.
No doubt about that. And how has the response been on the road?
Well, we closed the show in New York in January of 2011 and immediately outfitted it to become a touring production. And since 2011, we've been coast to coast, from Boston to San Diego, from Seattle to Miami, and all parts in between, and have been running since January 2011. So we're beginning our fourth year of our tour.
Fourth year of your tour, and you were about 4 years old, I think, when you came to the United States. Is that right?
No, I won't admit to that. No, I'm much older than that. Yes. I guess we should go to the next question.
Yeah, well, you were born in Panama.
That's right.
And
I came to the States when I was four, and my first objective was to master the English language, and been working on it ever since.
Well, the Screwtape Tape Letters is a satirical and apologetic novel written in the distinctive style by C.S. Lewis, first published in February of 1942. Talk about staying the course. It's been 72 years. It's quite a work of art.
Yes. He started writing it in July 1940, after hearing the famous Reichstag speech Hitler gave to the British people that was being translated on the BBC, and everybody in the UK was listening to it because the appeal was to the British people. He wanted to get across that he meant them no harm, that he had in mind a great civilization between the British and the Germans, led by the British and the Germans. And the longer this war goes on, the more it's keeping him from his great work, and that somebody needed to talk sense into Churchill before it was too late. And Lewis wrote to his brother that night after the broadcast was over that, you know, I may be weaker than most, but while he was speaking things that I knew were not true, he had me half convinced because he said them so persuasively, so unflinchingly. And he thought this ability to persuade for obviously malevolent purposes was something quite evil. And so the idea didn't come right then, but that was the germ of the idea. And then on Sunday, while in church, he thought these things should come more seasonably. He thought, oh, I got this idea about how an older devil could teach a younger devil in something that would be entertaining and amusing and instructive. And then he started writing a letter a week for a Church of England paper. And then they collected them all in 1942 for the publication you saw, and it had 8 printings in its first year.
A senior demon named Screwtape, 1942, mm-hmm. Right at the height of World War II. And at that time, in that place, the tensions were about as vivid as they've been at any time on Earth, haven't they?
I think that's right, and I do think that this heightened sense of mortality that was prevalent at that time. I mean, you know, there was air raids every night almost, and that they were, you know, you were really quite aware that this moment might be your last. So those sorts of things that it made it that people were keenly interested in the supernatural world, and so Lewis wrote this supernatural fantasy. It's very funny. It's quite satirical. Lewis created this morally inverted universe where up is down, good is bad, God is called the enemy, Satan's called our father below. And then he creates this magnificent central character, and when you read the book, you immediately get a sense of the personality because of the voice of the narrator, Screwtape, who is a kind of this master of the universe character who loves the way he looks, loves the way he talks, loves the way he dresses, just draws you right in. And we thought, actually, that if we could capture that voice, that seductive quality, and all those extraordinary, that constellation of ideas, and be able to articulate that and get that across theatrically, that we would have a pretty significant theatrical event.
Well, Lewis covers areas as diverse as sex, love, pride, gluttony, war.
Yeah, seven deadly sins are... They're still prevalent, I understand.
Yeah, I think they're still out there. Yeah, I think we all are occasionally fighting those seven deadly sins, some of us more than others. Now, how much did Lewis affect you? How much did Lewis affect you, Max?
Well, Lewis has always been a kind of a literary partner, you know, in my life, certainly more recently. Lewis is someone that you kind of have to work up to. I mean, people know him through Narnia, of course, and what he's done in Narnia is he takes the same ideas he has in his very deep apologetic works and his theological fantasies like Screwtape and like Great Divorce, and he makes them clear for children. But the ideas are the same. And so when you... Kind of the way it's been for me is, you know, you look at Narnia, then you go to the theological fantasies such as Screwtape and The Great Divorce, then Mere Christianity, and then you get into his deeper essays and his literary works, and you find out that you just don't get to the bottom of him.
And you have had a varied life and a successful one, but one of the aspects of your life is to recapture the early oral tradition of telling the biblical story.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I've narrated the Bible on five different occasions in various translations, and, you know, got the sense of you get the sweep of the story and the vividness of the characters. You know, Lewis was also very helpful there, you know, in his defense of the Bible as authentic. He said that the critics, it is reporting, or that these writers were anticipating realistic psychological novels of the 19th century back then. And so when, you know, read that, and I said, okay, just tell the story as reporting. And it really jumps off the page.
Well, one of the great ironies of life is that C.S. Lewis, who was born in 1898, died on November 22nd, 1963.
Mm-hmm.
Same day as John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And in many ways, he had an impact on our society that I think it may not equal that of JFK, but it was among the most intense and profound of the 20th century.
Well, I just read an article in The Atlantic, a pretty long one, arguing actually that Lewis may have, in the long run, have had a bigger impact than JFK and a third person that died that day, Aldous Huxley. All three died the same day. It was interesting because at Lewis's funeral, there were maybe eight people that attended.
Eight?
Very few people actually knew about it. Whereas Kennedy, of course, you know, was so tragic. And yet, since his death, and it's very rare for an author to outlive his time, that people are still reading him after he dies. And yet every year, Lewis gets more and more followers. I think he's sold over 200 million books since he's died. Obviously, the Narnia ones would be the bestsellers, but Screwtape and Mere Christianity and Great Divorce and some of the others have sold quite well as well.
What will we see and hear on stage tomorrow night?
Well, you're going to... One thing, it's theater. We've made a theatrical adaptation, a great set, sound design, light design, two terrific actors that will entertain the audience with extraordinary wit and humor that comes from the pen of C.S. Lewis. You'll see a hunt story between Screwtape, who's after a particular everyman on Earth called the Patient, who begins his journey as indifferent to spiritual things, and by the end of the play, he's quite devout, and this in spite of all the efforts of Screwtape to ruin him. And then you have Screwtape, the more theatrical arc of the play, who begins the play as this Master of the Universe character, and by the end of the play, he's a defeated devil, and the entertainment is how that happens. So we want people to be entertained. I think for a lot of people, it'll be very provocative, in some cases convicting, and occasionally it might even be life-changing.
Yeah. Well, you, like I, were born well after the conclusion of World War II, and what you said about Hitler, for those who lived during that time, he didn't gain control of Germany and a good portion of Europe without having some appeal. How did he have that kind of appeal, despite all the obvious flaws and the evil within him?
Well, some of that is he had an extraordinary will. I'm not a historian of that period, but I have watched tapes of him, and his charisma was extraordinary. Although once the war started, he became a cave dweller. He hid in himself. He was not the leader that, for instance, Churchill was after the war began. When things were going well, he was quite out there, very public. But when things turned, he became a bit of a coward, went into a bunker, and isolated himself.
And did the ultimately cowardly thing by killing himself.
Right. Well, he knew it was over. But it was interesting. I mean, he did have an appeal. And I think that's one of the interesting things about Screwtape, is that the seductive quality has to be there. You know, there's a certain sense that you're kind of rooting for the bad guy, and that gives you a very uncomfortable feeling. And yet it's also what captures your imagination, because the kinds of things that Screwtape says, when two humans live together, it usually happens. Each has tones of voice and expressions of face that are unendurably irritating to the other. Work on that. When you get those things direct, you know, don't irritate anybody. You say, yeah, okay, I won't. But that doesn't capture your imagination. But when you get it in the reverse way, you go, whoa, I do that. And you begin to kind of look at yourself a little bit more deeply and evaluate yourself a little bit more deeply. And I think that's the power of Screwtape.
Well, it'll be a powerful production in our midst tomorrow night, River Center, Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Max, by the way, we have two shows tomorrow. It's 4 and 8.
Okay, that's good to know. So you got two shots to see The Screwtape Letters, a production from Max MacLean, and it was an overwhelming success in the toughest of places to be a success, New York City. Thank you, Max.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
We're glad that folks are listening, and for those who are working today, we appreciate your contributions to society on a rough day. The weather's kind of rough, but in this community, it wasn't all that difficult to get around other than the closed roads today. Other parts of the state, it's a different story. It is a dangerous situation in other parts of Louisiana, but thanks to the staff at Louis, they're bright and early, despite the elements today. And a few items to discuss as we finish up the week. I had John Treen on this show a few days ago, the veteran Republican politico who lost to David Duke 25 years ago this week for a state House seat by 227 votes. Actually, the runoff was in February of 1989, but the primary was 25 years ago this week. John Treen, no fan of David Duke, and for good reason, disputed the fact that Duke's father was a military veteran, and I've looked at several bios of Mr. Duke, including one from Kenneth Stern, who wrote a nice piece several years ago called A Nazi in Politics, and He says David Ernest Duke was born in Tulsa on July 1, 1950, grew up idealizing his father, David Hedger Duke, an engineer and an officer in the Army Reserve. So despite David Duke's problems, which were self-made, I don't think his father shared his affinity for Adolf Hitler or the Third Reich. And we'll talk more about what's happening in Louisiana. Governor Jindal officially unveiling his budget today. Good news for some people. There's an increase in funding for CODAFIL, the Council for Development of French in Louisiana, $150,000. But others taking it on the chin. We'll talk about that and much more as we visit with you next week. Thank you for listening today. Have a great weekend. Be safe and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.